You're so easy. Thank you.
Not even the one I went to describe.
Ruego tomar asiento, por favor.
Please take your seats.
Se declara abierta.
The eighth meeting of the ninth session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, this morning the Permanent Forum will take up item 6 of its agenda, entitled Comprehensive Dialogue with 6 United Nations Agencies and Funds. The forum will hold a dialogue with the Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity and also will take up the report of the annual session of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues. I will invite Mr. Scott, the focal point for non-governmental organizations of the Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity, to introduce the report of the CBD Secretariat. After the presentation, forum members, delegations of the observers, organizations of Indigenous peoples, and other participants who wish to ask questions will be given that opportunity. Mr. John Scott will respond to the questions and will make comments. Also under item 6, the Permanent Forum will hear a statement from Ms. Yamina Jagda, the Deputy Director of the UN Habitat New York Office, who will present the annual report of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues. I now invite Mr. John Scott and Ms. Jagda to join me on the podium. You're already here. Welcome to you. First, I give the floor to Mr. John Scott, the focal point for non-governmental organizations of the Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity. You have the floor, Mr. Scott.
Hello. It's working. Good morning, everyone. It gives me great pleasure to address you this morning, and I have a short statement before our question and answer period. Something more than 500 Indigenous and local community organisations participate in the work of the CBD. At the governing body, we usually get between 500 and 700 Indigenous peoples attending. We call the governing body the COP, the Conference of the Parties. The COP often attracts between 5 and 6,000 people, and the governing body will be convened this October in Nagoya in Japan. At the working groups, and in particular the Working Group on Traditional Knowledge, we have between 50 to 200 Indigenous organisations participating out of a total of between 500 and 600 participants. The CBD, the Convention on Biodiversity, is the only multilateral environmental agreement which has a voluntary fund for Indigenous participation. And the information on the voluntary fund and application forms are available through the convention's webpage in the 6 languages of the United Nations. The voluntary fund has a selection committee, an Indigenous selection committee made up of 7 Indigenous peoples from the 7 regions recognised by the Permanent Forum. We prioritise the selection of Indigenous women and youth in the voluntary fund. The Convention on Biodiversity is an almost universal instrument to which 193 nations now adhere. It has 3 objectives: the conservation of biological diversity, plants and animals, including microbes, the sustainable use of its components, and the fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising from the use of genetic resources. We call this process dealing with genetic resources and associated traditional knowledge ABS. This is the acronym, As you know, in the UN, we have a special language all of our own. Spanning the thematic work programs of the CBD are cross-cutting issues of traditional knowledge and access and benefit sharing. So traditional knowledge is taken into account across all the work areas of the CBD. The international community has recognized the close and traditional dependence of many indigenous and local communities on biological resources, and most notably in the very preamble of the convention itself. There is also broad recognition of the contribution that traditional knowledge can make to both the conservation and sustainable use of biological diversity, two fundamental objectives of the convention. The Conference of the Parties has established a working group specifically to address the implementation of Article 8J, which calls on member states to respect, promote, and preserve traditional knowledge, but it can only be promoted with the approval of the knowledge holders. The ad hoc open-ended intersessional working group on Article 8J, which is the working group that deals with traditional knowledge, is responsible for the development and implementation of an extensive work program with the full participation of Indigenous and local communities. The working group on Article 8J is open to all parties, and Indigenous and local communities play a full and active role in its work. The working group includes enhanced participation mechanisms for Indigenous and local communities, including the nomination of an Indigenous co-chairperson to assist the chairperson of the meeting, as well as an Indigenous and local community bureau referred to as the Friends of the Chair, and co-chairs for any sub-working groups or contact groups that may be established to deal with difficult issues. So Indigenous and local communities enjoy enhanced opportunities to make interventions on all the agenda items during our meeting. Our last meeting was the sixth meeting of the Working Group on Article 8J, which met last November in Montreal. The traditional knowledge is considered a cross-cutting issue that affects many aspects of biodiversity. It is taken into account and addressed by the Conference of the Parties and by the working groups, as well as by Article 8J. I would also like to point out that many years ago, 7 years ago, there was a recommendation from the Permanent Forum asking us to develop a code of ethics to protect Indigenous intellectual property and cultural heritage, and that code has been finalised and will be adopted at COP10 in October this year. So it takes us a long time, but I hope that it's a good product that is useful and that it's fully implemented. I also should say we have many Indigenous partners, many NGO partners, and later this morning Conservation International will present an intervention. We are working with Conservation International. They have an initiative to set up an Indigenous youth fellowship program inside the organisation, and we are looking to support them in that process. And Kristen Walker will elaborate on that a little bit later this morning. At that, I'm going to stop now so we can have a real dialogue. I would like to think this morning we can have an open dialogue and talk to each other. And I know that the members have some questions, and I'm eager to start our dialogue. So thank you very much, everyone.
Doy las gracias al señor Scott por su.
I thank Mr. Scott for his statement. I now open the floor for questions and comments from the members of the Permanent Forum, delegations of the observers, IPOs, and other participants. Any questions from colleagues? Victoria Tauli, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, John Scott, for the presentation you made and also for the report that you gave to the Permanent Forum, which is contained in the document number, I'll just check, E/C19, 2010/3. This is the report that you gave to us to report on what you have achieved in terms of the recommendations that the Permanent Forum has put before you in the last session. One of the concerns, we are very much concerned about the progress on the issue related to the negotiations on access and benefit sharing. As you will know, in the report, page 15 of your report to the ninth session, you mentioned, and I quote, the Secretariat of the CBD in partnership with the government of Germany through the German Agency for Technical Cooperation is pursuing an access and benefit sharing capacity building in the African region, and indigenous and local communities representatives are regularly included in these workshops and in the regional capacity building workshops on protected areas. So I have two questions related to this whole issue of access and benefit sharing. My first question is, I've been following very closely the progress of the negotiations in the development of an international regime on access and benefit sharing of genetic resources. I have met with some of the colleagues, the indigenous representatives who have been actively participating in the processes up till Cali, the meeting that was held in Cali. And the sense that I got from them is that there is not much progress in those negotiations in relation to the parties integrating the need to really fully recognize in traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples, as well as integrating the need to recognize the rights of indigenous peoples, their free, prior, and informed consent when access is being done on their genetic resources. And I'm very worried about this because if the protocol is going to be adopted in Nagoya at the Conference of Parties, the 10th Conference of Parties, I think it's going to be dangerous if there's a protocol that will come out that will not explicitly say that they are recognizing the rights of indigenous peoples as contained in the declaration and the rights of indigenous peoples to have their free, prior, and informed consent obtained before any access to their genetic resources is ensured, no? So it's done. So I think I would like to know exactly the, at least from your point of view as the Secretariat, what are going to be the ways that can be done in terms of ensuring that this comes in, and what role can the forum play along those lines. And of course, in relation to this capacity building activities that is being done in Africa, I would like to know what are these capacity building activities and what are the lessons that you have learned in doing this, and whether you have really built the capacity of indigenous peoples of Africa to influence the African governments and the other governments. I know that the African governments are sympathetic to indigenous peoples' issue, but the main sticking issue is the fact that parties are still insisting that national sovereignty over genetic resources is the primary principle that should rule this kind of protocol. And indigenous peoples have strongly been protesting against it, saying that they also have permanent sovereignty over their natural resources. No? So I think that's the issue that has to be addressed, and I would like to get your views on this. Related to this is, of course, the interventions that indigenous peoples are doing on the working group on access and benefit sharing, wherein I know that the government of Spain has also provided resources for long-term capacity building. No? But I think that will be pursued further by my colleague in ELISA. But those are my main concern really is the access and benefit sharing negotiations and what can be done to really not lose all the gains that we have achieved in terms of ensuring that parties who are also the same parties who adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples are saying a totally different thing in that whole process. Thank you very much.
Gracias, señora Tauli.
Thank you, Ms. Tauli. Now, we will hear a statement by our colleague, Ms. Margaret Ottawa. You have the floor, Margaret.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take the floor this morning, and I appreciate the speech given by our panelists this morning from the Secretariat of Convention on Biological Diversity. We know that the current phenomena today is climate change that has affected many indigenous peoples, and it's really so interesting that some of these issues are being handled by your department concerning the issue of capacity building that my colleague has just raised. The other one I wanted to raise is the issue of indigenous peoples attending to these meetings. You know, that is one of the challenges indigenous people face to get into these very important meetings. And I'm just wondering how effective distribution your department has done, especially to ensure that indigenous people from different regions attend these meetings. And it would be very interesting and very important also to know the effectiveness of the capacity building that you've just mentioned on the side of African, indigenous peoples, to what degree it has, reached to this moment. Thank you very much.
Gracias, señora.
Thank you, Ms. Lokawa. Mr. Scott has the floor.
Thank you. Firstly, I want to introduce my colleague, Florina Lopez, who is an indigenous Kuna woman from Panama, and she is also the chair of the Indigenous Women's Biodiversity Network for Latin America. And we have an MOU with Florina to do extensive sub-regional workshops in Latin America. When the opportunity arises, I will let her give you the details of what the work we're doing in Latin America. What you might find interesting is we've been able to pursue the strategy of capacity building in Latin America because the government of Spain has been a patron for work in Latin America. And so it often depends on finding somebody. We work with voluntary donations. So for us to do work in a region or a country, we will need to find donors to assist us. And it's been very successful in Spain, with Spain as a patron, and our work in Latin America, I think, should be showcased. And in a little while, Florina will take the floor on that. Firstly, I'm going to take the questions just two at a time because these are extremely complicated matters when we're talking about international negotiations and then regional capacity building strategies. So firstly, I would like to respond to some of Vicky Tully Corpus's questions about ABS. ABS is the acronym we use. The long phrase is access to genetic resources and associated traditional knowledge and the equitable sharing of benefits arising from their utilization. So we sum that long sentence up by saying ABS. The ABS negotiations have been going on for 7 or 8 years now, and this year they are reaching ahead. We just had what was supposedly our final meeting, the 9th meeting of the Working Group on ABS in Colombia, in Cali, and I was there 2 weeks before I came here to New York. The negotiations, I actually think that they were going quite well when we were in contact groups, but in the final 3 days, it became apparent that not everybody at the table was prepared to negotiate, and therefore the meeting, the parties decided to reconvene the meeting in July of this year. I've just received the dates. I don't have them in front of me. I only received them last night. Unfortunately, the dates will be exactly the same dates as the expert mechanism meeting in Geneva. But the 9th meeting of the Working Group on ABS will resume in Montreal in mid-July. And that information I only received last night. If I could talk a little bit about the negotiations. Okay. Sorry, I'm just consulting my notes. Article 8J requires that parties respect, preserve and promote traditional knowledge with the approval of the knowledge holders. The parties, although there seems to be some agreement on the term of prior and informed consent, there is not universal consensus among the parties on whether approval, which is already required under Article 8J, is interpreted as PIC or not. And this is yet to be resolved. As you know, the 193 parties to the convention make decisions by consensus. And just as the members, the 16 members of the Permanent Forum, make decisions by consensus, and you can understand how difficult that process is. You can imagine how difficult a process is to get 193 governments to agree on something, anything almost. But I'd like to talk about the details of ABS. Just one moment. Okay. Of course, the Indigenous peoples at the convention work through an Indigenous caucus called the International Indigenous Forum on Biodiversity. It uses an acronym IIFFB. ILCs also participate on government delegations, and the IIFB remains open to them also. The parties at the moment remain open to Indigenous positions on traditional knowledge, and some regional groups share similar positions to Indigenous peoples on issues such as traditional knowledge. There are alliances between regional groups of governments and Indigenous peoples on issues that they agree on. And the issue of prior and informed consent, for instance, is largely supported by the African region, very strongly supported by the African region at this time. Now, most disagreement or divergence within the negotiations arise from the diverse ways that governments approach ABS and traditional knowledge issues. Some governments want to be involved in detail. For instance, in the African region, some governments have expressed concern that Indigenous and local communities may not have sufficient capacity to negotiate ABS agreements, including minimal standards of benefit sharing. Therefore, they seek to play a very active role in protecting the interests of Indigenous and local communities to ensure that benefits are equitably are received and equitably distributed. The African region would also support the government ticking off that prior and informed consent was achieved in accessing traditional knowledge. And this view is also shared in some parts by Asian and Latin American governments and by a group we call the mega diverse countries. On the other hand, some developed world countries take a different view and they approach ABS in a different way. Some consider traditional knowledge is solely under the authority of Indigenous peoples, and therefore they would consider it inappropriate to get involved at all, including in confirming if PIC had been obtained when traditional knowledge is accessed, or in establishing modalities for minimal standards of benefit sharing. They just feel that they should not have a role in this whatsoever. So some of the developed world governments have stated that it is not appropriate for governments to get involved in arrangements between users of traditional knowledge and the holders of that traditional knowledge. Now, unfortunately, ultimately, the negotiations have to seek a middle ground, as the final protocol must be adopted by consensus of 193 member states. So one of the problems are, of course, Indigenous peoples ourselves are extremely diverse. Our customary laws are extremely diverse. The situations we live under are extremely diverse. And we have to find an arrangement that will accommodate that full diversity. There's an ongoing discussion, of course, about the issue of genetic resources. At this time, I think governments themselves are also progressing their understanding of what sovereignty means. And sovereignty, of course, provides legitimate governments with the authority to administer their resources. Of course, we're also familiar that under human rights law, resources are actually owned by peoples with an S. So government sovereignty can sit with this without any conflict. It depends on how this is interpreted. Some of the indigenous peoples following the CBD, and particularly some of the indigenous lawyers, have actually suggested to me that it would not be a concern if the CBD was silent on the ownership of genetic resources, and that this issue was resolved in a different forum, a more appropriate forum, such as a human rights forum. And they have reminded me something that I've learned within the UN system, that also being silent on something can be very powerful in international law. Maybe that at least in part answers the questions, but the fact that the working group did not arrive at a consensus in March when it met, and it met for, we're in Cali for almost 3 weeks. The very first meeting we arranged was an Indigenous negotiators meeting to prepare Indigenous peoples for the negotiation. But the governments themselves have still not arrived at consensus, and they need to reconvene to continue what is a very difficult and intense negotiation again in July in Montreal, with the view of adopting a legally enforceable protocol in Nagoya. I don't think people should be overly pessimistic, because already the fact that the governments have moved to a position that they want a legally binding protocol is a significant step forward, and they have also agreed to work on the basis of a chair's text, which still contains a lot of very useful elements for Indigenous peoples. So the game is not over yet. We are in a very difficult negotiation, and Indigenous peoples continue to work because you work very closely, Vicky, with many of the Indigenous peoples involved in this process. People work very long hours at these meetings, and they continue to push the issues, which are still contained in the draft chair's text. That is the current that parties have agreed will be the text that they negotiate on. One of the problems Indigenous peoples face now is the game has changed, and we've moved away from general positions, and people must negotiate pieces of text. And of course, after the meeting hours, we do not have the 6 UN language interpretation. So a lot of Indigenous peoples, especially our brothers and sisters in Latin America, North Africa, French-speaking Africa, are very challenged when the contact groups are all conducted in English. But this is the usual UN practice when negotiations continue beyond the usual meeting hours. But I think, for instance, there's also a discussion at the moment within the negotiation text. There is recognition of Indigenous peoples' rights. And Indigenous peoples themselves who participate in the CBD are also having a discussion whether adding the declaration would make any difference right now. The main thing is that it respects Indigenous rights, and that really means that it must pay attention to the declaration. So even Indigenous peoples themselves are now wondering whether they should simply fight to maintain the phrase that recognises Indigenous peoples' rights, or whether they should continue to advocate for the inclusion of a reference to the declaration in the preamble. So it's a difficult negotiation. We're at the stage where we're negotiating phrases and words, and it remains a difficult negotiation, especially for Indigenous peoples and especially for those who do not work in English. Now, if I could, and I'm quite welcome to come back to any further questions on ABS, because it's a critical issue for Indigenous peoples, and this is the critical moment. Also, as Vicky pointed out, this is the first piece of international law that has been negotiated since the adoption of the declaration in September 2007. So this really matters to Indigenous peoples. What comes out of this protocol will show you whether the adoption of the declaration is being taken into account in the development of international law. This is the first piece of international law developed since the adoption of the declaration. And I think the Indigenous peoples' eyes from all over the world are focused on this process. Now I'd like to leave the ABS and talk a little bit about what Margaret kindly brought up our distinguished representative from Africa at the forum about capacity building in Africa. As I mentioned before with Latin America, being able to do regional capacity building strategies will often depend on finding a patron. Now, fortunately, in Africa, there is an ABS initiative on capacity development for Africa. It's not aimed specifically at indigenous and local communities, but they are invited to all of the meetings. The ABS initiative on capacity building for Africa is a multi-donor initiative funded by Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, La Francophonie, and implemented by the German Development Agency, GTZ, and the Secretariat of the Convention on Biodiversity is a partner in this initiative. Now, the initiative has organized a long list of workshops over the last few years, and the CPD is an active participant in those as a presenter and in helping to organize them. But we do not lead this. It's led by GTZ, and we are their partner. Some of the workshops carried out in recent months are the 4th Pan-African ABS Capacity Building Workshop in December 2009, the ABS Capacity Building Workshop for Eastern and Southern Africa, hosted by the Institute for Biodiversity Conservation in September 2009 at the Institute of Biodiversity in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and the African Indigenous and Local Community Preparatory Meeting on ABS and TK in Nairobi, September 2009. The preparatory meeting was held with a view of strengthening the voice of African Indigenous peoples and local communities in the international arena to provide a forum for open exchange and discussion amongst Indigenous representatives from all over Africa on relevant topics under the convention. And the full details of all of these workshops and workshops going back a number of years are available at a webpage. I'll give this to you in writing, Margaret, but the webpage is www.abs-africa.info, and I'll write that down and make it available to you. Thank you.
Gracias, señor Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. We've planned for an active dialogue between delegates and the Secretariat on biological diversity. So I'm going to ask that we be careful with our use of time, otherwise we'll have a long list of speakers who won't be able to take the floor. Ms. Elisa Kanki has the floor now. Elisa, please.
I will give the floor to my colleagues who are present in the permanent forum session, so I will not ask any kind of question. Thank you.
Entonces damos inicio al...
So we'll begin with our list of speakers, and we'll use our machine here to monitor the time. And we also invite you to ask questions, to put questions to Mr. Scott. The first person on our list of speakers is Mr. Yangurchi Agiev of the Russian Caucus. Mr. Agiev, you have the floor.
Está presente en la sala, señor.
Is Mr. Agiev in the hall?
Palabra.
You have the floor, sir.
Как хорошо, что мне слово представили. Здравствуйте, уважаемые.
Good morning, participants of the Permanent Forum. I represent the Russian Federation. My organization is a regional public organization representing an indigenous people in the Russian Federation. In Dagestan, indigenous peoples are deprived of their constitutional rights. Political genocide is ongoing in Dagestan. There are attempts to violently uproot people and displace them. The Presidium of the Supreme Soviet or the RSFSR in 1947 set up artificial borders within Dagestan. And the entire region was reorganized. Various cities and territories were reallocated to Dagestan. This reorganization from 1957 has prevented the achievement of autonomy for indigenous peoples in Dagestan. The government of Dagestan has a long-term plan for the liquidation of villages and towns throughout the region. This has been taking place since the 1950s. It's all very cynical, this process. From year to year, we are seeing discriminatory laws being adopted with respect to the peoples of the region.
Pedimos solucionar el problema de la traducción.
Can the interpretation be heard? It seems there was a problem, a technical problem. Can the interpretation be heard? Fine, thank you. Thank you.
The creation of these types of, our people needs to be able to enjoy autonomy. We need to enjoy self-governance. But unfortunately, this is not the case. The government of Dagestan and the government has been carrying out a policy of resettlement of people from mountain areas to lowland areas. Our people are facing many, many problems concerning property and so forth, land ownership, and the promulgation of their culture. Therefore, there's a need to draw attention to these issues today. Otherwise, there will be worsening of national conflict in the Republic of Dagestan, and this will hamper social development in the future. We would call upon the forum to focus on the difficult situation in Dagestan. We would suggest that the Permanent Forum send a special rapporteur to Dagestan in order to look at the problems faced by the peoples of the North Caucasus.
Yeah. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Once again, I want to remind you that our topic today is a dialogue with the Secretariat on biodiversity. So I invite the speakers on the list to ask questions that relate to the statement made by Mr. John Scott, and not to make general statements or statements that relate to issues that we have already discussed. I give the floor to Mr. Les Malazer from the Pacific Caucus. Mr. Malazer, you have the floor.
Señor Malazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Thank you. Mr. Chairperson, I do have questions to ask of Mr. Scott. First off, we'd like to thank very much Mr. Scott for his work in the CBD Secretariat, which has assisted our delegations at the CBD meetings. However, we note that his position, as we understand, is related to Article 8J, and we have the question, should the Secretariat have a more substantial unit which is addressing the rights of Indigenous peoples as right holders with the self-determination, control of our lands, territories and resources, and inseparable ties to biodiversity? So should, in fact, the CBD Secretariat be strengthening the support that is being given to our delegations? I have a few questions here. Secondly, what events are being organised this year for Indigenous peoples to celebrate the International Year of Biodiversity at the international level? The next question is, how will Indigenous peoples be assisted to hold a meaningful display and presence at the COP10 meeting in Nagoya in Japan? Can Indigenous peoples in the Pacific region who face critical changes to marine and terrestrial environments which affect our very existence be assisted by the parties to meet and organise as Indigenous peoples? The next question is, can states, particularly Australia and New Zealand, contribute more to the voluntary fund to ensure that Indigenous peoples in the Pacific can have greater representation across a range of CBD meetings? At the moment, there are very few representatives at very few meetings because of the limitations. The next question is, are the parties to the CBD opposed to reference to us as Indigenous peoples, as was acknowledged in the declaration adopted by the General Assembly in 2007, and will they be insisting on referring to us only as Indigenous and local communities, which is an inferior status? The next question is the CBD Secretariat continuing to take account of the recommendations which came from the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in 2007 and contained in the report of the International Expert Group meeting on the International Regime on Access and Benefit Sharing and Indigenous Peoples' Human Rights under the CBD? And the final question, Mr. Chairperson, the report by the CBD from the meeting of the International Indigenous and Local Community Consultation on Access and Benefit Sharing and Development of an International Regime, which is a report to ABS 5 called Information 9. It was provided as an information paper to the working group, but the Permanent Forum had requested that the recommendations be considered by the working group. And is that possible, that to get the working group to actually consider the human rights issues that are raised in the reports that I've mentioned? Mr. Chairman, I'll end there, but I will say we have a prepared statement which we'll hand in, and we have five recommendations for the Permanent Forum under the CBD heading. Thank you very much.
Gracias, señor Malecer.
Thank you, Mr. Malecer. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Albert de Terville from the Caribbean Caucus. I would ask Mr. de Terville to ask questions on the specific item before us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Since this is the first time I'm intervening and it would be the last time for this session, let me just report to the Permanent Forum on activities taking place within the CARICOM region, the CARICOM Caribbean region, the 14 countries of CARICOM, with regard to the presentation made by Mr. Scott. We wish to inform the Permanent Forum that at this present time, the World Intellectual Property Organization and the governments of CARICOM engaged in an activity in CARICOM for the 14 countries, independent states of CARICOM. The establishment of a regional law for the protection of traditional knowledge, traditional cultural expressions, and genetic resources. Being part one of the experts on the working group advising the governments of CARICOM and also representing the interests of indigenous and local communities, we have held seven national consultations in seven countries of CARICOM. The law, regional law for the 14 countries may come into being in the next 2 years. It would implicate the Article HJ as well as the ABS protocol on the Convention on Biological Diversity. I wish to ask Mr. Scott that when the law, the regional law, comes into being, how would the Convention on Biological Diversity interact in providing advice to the governments of CARICOM and indigenous peoples and local communities within that region? I wish to also inform the permanent forum, since I didn't have the time to do so. This is the third attempt to speak to the forum, to inform the forum that the government of St. Lucia has engaged in a number of activities with indigenous peoples. And that relates to, one, inviting indigenous peoples to submit a chapter in the new constitution in St. Lucia. We were asked to do so, and we recommended that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples be included as part of the new constitution of St. Lucia. Let me also inform the permanent forum that we were among the first to translate the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in our own indigenous language, and that is part of the Secretariat documents, and it's on the website. So I wish to thank you, sir, Mr. Chair, for giving me this opportunity to inform the permanent forum of what is taking place within the CARICOM, 14 countries of CARICOM, as it relates to Article 38 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that encourages collaboration between indigenous peoples and states in the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So I would expect that Mr. Scott would respond to the question that I asked in relation to the regional law for the protection of genetic resources, traditional knowledge, and traditional cultural expressions of indigenous peoples and local communities in the Caribbean region, as opposed to the ABS protocol and the Convention on Biological Diversity. Thank you very much, sir.
Gracias, señor de Terville.
Thank you, Mr. de Terville. Ms. Florina Lopez will be adding to the statement made by Mr. Scott. Ms. Lopez, you have the floor. Thank you, and a very good morning to all of you. Yes, I wanted to add a bit to what Mr. John Scott has said about capacity building in the Latin American region, taking into account meetings on capacity building for indigenous communities and local communities, and also thanks to the general support of the government of Spain. The Network on Biodiversity has been conducting activities on the basis of an agreement that we signed last year in Paris, parallel to the meeting on CBD in Paris. We began this process, although in the past, with the support of the government of Spain, we had already had some regional workshops on the subject of the Convention on Biological Diversity. All of this with the objective of having indigenous peoples and local communities able to participate better in this extremely complicated, extremely difficult process in a system that we often don't understand, where the indigenous peoples have to be present. As John Scott said, we have to empower people. We, as indigenous peoples, have to participate. The same applies to genetic resources, where we're involved in very critical negotiations, where the indigenous peoples need to be equals at the negotiating table. That's why this women's network, Indigenous Women's Network, has little by little been conducting training and increasing the capacities of Indigenous women, also on the basis of some progress that we've made in the process of the Convention on Biodiversity. During COP9, the plan, Gender Plan of Action, was adopted, and the Women's Network participated in the development of that as well. As an objective of the agreement, we want to strengthen the capacity of Indigenous women throughout the discussion process and in decision-making on the subject of the CBD, because we've seen that in these meetings where Indigenous women have been participating, often we arrive at the meeting without knowing exactly what topics are going to be discussed. And that's why states sometimes take advantage of what we might call that weakness, a lack of in-depth knowledge as to how the UN system functions, especially on the subject of the CBD. What topics are being discussed? What is the form of participation? And for the indigenous peoples, both men and women, a subject of primary concern to us is that of traditional knowledge, which is dealt with in Article 8J. And it's also a question of knowing that the indigenous peoples must be involved. States must be made to understand that the subject of the human rights of indigenous peoples is not something separate from what is discussed under the CBD. It's a cross-cutting issue in every sense of the word. So we, as the Women's Indigenous Network, are conducting workshops. The first one was in February of 2010 in Argentina. It was for Paraguay, Chile, Uruguay, and Argentina, basically. The second workshop that was held was in March of 2010 in Guatemala, and that was for the Mesoamerica region. We're also organizing a third workshop, and that will be in Brazil, in Brasilia, in June, early June. The meeting has already been convened. In other words, invitations have been sent. It is open to everyone, youth, adults, organizations, and that will be for the Amazonia region. There'll be another workshop for the Andean region, and that will be in July. We're also organizing a meeting in Montreal on ABS. There's also going to be a Latin American workshop, which will gather together all of these sub-regional workshops, the results of the sub-regional workshops, to consider the progress that's been made in this capacity building for indigenous peoples and local communities. The Latin American workshop will be in August in Panama, with the participation, well, it won't be everyone who was in the sub-regionals, because we're seeing that we don't have enough resources for that. We would like to have broad participation, and there will be broad participation in the sub-regional seminars, but because of constraints on resources, we often need to have a reduced participation. It's extremely important to us that women, especially young women, participate in the process so that they can have an impact on the convention, but an impact at the national level as well. Because the decisions that are taken as part of this process will become national laws. so we in the Women's Network can then have an impact on the decision-making at the local level. Because for the decision-making process, we need to have this tool so that clear decisions can be taken on what we want to see implemented or not implemented on our lands and territories. So these workshops are being conducted, and it's a 3-year agreement. So we'll see the results this year. We see it as a great achievement that we have this kind of support in this process. Because often, as I said before, we come to such meetings without an in-depth knowledge of what's going to be done. Because these are negotiating bodies, and our future is at stake, our resources, our biodiversity, our culture, our entire lives, our way of living is at stake. And we want to leave that legacy to our future generations. So we need to be extremely clear about the positions that we're going to take, about what kind of impact we can make, whether we should or should not be participating in the process. States take decisions sometimes without us, almost all the time. So day by day, we need to understand more how to manage this process and this system in which we're all also involved. That is an obligation that we have, an obligation toward our indigenous peoples, that we have an impact so that our proposals can be heard, and so that the proposals we make are of high quality. So this capacity building and training process, as we see it, is a true achievement of the network of indigenous women. We know it's a difficult process. It's a long-term process. We know that it won't be a 100% success overnight. But we think that taking into account the support of other institutions and other organizations that are also making their contributions, we can make further progress. We have the capacity, but we need to develop it. And we need to understand these tools that are difficult to manage, these tools in the international organizations. So I'm very grateful to the Secretariat for all the support given to us in this process, and we hope to continue to have that support. And we hope states will support us with resources as well, because that's part of the mandate of the Conference of the Parties. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Nuestra próxima oradora de la lista.
The next speaker on our list. Oh, we'll ask Mr. Scott to provide some answers. We do have a very long list of speakers from the indigenous peoples who would like to ask questions, Mr. Scott.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Florina especially. I think that the work being done in Latin America is a model for other regions, and we're looking for patrons from donor states so that we can develop similar models in other regions to build capacity on the convention. Indigenous peoples like herself follow this particular issue sometimes their whole lives. It's a very complicated process, the CBD, and it takes a lot of commitment, and I really applaud Florina's work as the coordinator of the Indigenous Women's Biodiversity Network for Latin America. I would like this to be conversational, and Mr. Melzer has kindly asked some questions, and I would encourage everybody to ask questions that can be responded to so we can have a dialogue and not simply a monologue this morning. And Mr. Melzer, I hope that I've captured most of the questions. I'll try and respond, and please remind me if I haven't. I do have two assistants at the CBD, which is recent. Until then, I was the sole person responsible for traditional knowledge at the CBD. So, of course, I applaud your efforts to have a substantial unit to deal with these issues. I certainly would support that recommendation. I think, you raise an interesting issue. We deal specifically with traditional knowledge, and this, in fact, is touches on a much larger parcel of issues for Indigenous peoples. But we do approach traditional knowledge from a holistic way. We use it as a cross-cutting issue to ensure Indigenous perspectives are embedded across all the thematic areas of the Convention, whether that's marine and coastal waters or inland waters or climate change or forests or any of the other programs of work. And I should remind you, of course, that the structure of the Secretariat itself is determined by the 193 governments that make up the Convention itself. And the structure was put into place when the Convention was first developed in the early 1990s. But I certainly am interested in your idea of giving me more resources. What events are being prepared for this year? We've already had a busy year. And, of course, recently we were in Kali and we had the opportunity to have an Indigenous negotiators meeting between the 13th and 15th of March to prepare people for the ABS negotiations. We also have some money remaining from that budget, and we will be working with the Indigenous representatives to look at bringing Indigenous negotiators together again to prepare for the resumed session of the Working Group on ABS, and I'll be talking to the Indigenous regional reps about that. Also between the 8th and 10th of June in Montreal, the CBD and UNESCO is a partner in the Global Conference on Biological and Cultural Diversity for Development, and Indigenous peoples are being invited to that. We have some money to assist Indigenous participation, and we're hoping that this meeting will send a draft decision to our governing body to develop a joint program of work between the Convention, UNESCO, and NGO partners and Indigenous peoples organisations and other relevant organisations to do concrete work pursuing this connectivity between the different forms of diversity, biological and cultural diversity. Of course, we have our governing body meeting in Nagoya, Japan, and it usually attracts between 5,000 and 6,000 people. We often get between 500 and 700 Indigenous peoples participating in that meeting, and there will be an Indigenous program established that will run during the conference of the parties. That's all the events that we have planned for this year. Of course, our events also depend on attracting donor governments. And your suggestion that some donor states may like to contribute to our voluntary fund, I support your recommendation. It's difficult for us to support Indigenous participants from the developed world. We can usually only bring one or two people from a developed country because the money is focused on bringing people from the Indigenous peoples from the developing world. We can always do with more funding in the voluntary fund. I think the backbone of the CBD is the effective participation of Indigenous peoples, and we can only guarantee that if we have enough money to bring them to our meetings and, of course, as Florina said, to build their capacity so that they can effectively participate in our meetings. So I'll stop there, and I hope that we can continue on a question and answer format and make this a dialogue. Thank you.
Pedimos a la señora Victoria.
Ms. Victoria Tauli Corpus, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I wanted to come back because there are some other questions that were prepared by the members of the forum, but which were not communicated earlier. So I'd just like to raise these three questions. One was the point of the secretary of the CBD report to the ninth session, where it said that the secretariat has noted that some permanent forum recommendations are directed to the conference of parties and some are directed to the secretariat. So on occasion, it is not clear to whom these are directed. So I would like to ask John Scott, what suggestions can you make to address this situation? The second question is, of course, the whole issue again of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. You mentioned earlier that there were some discussions whether the declaration should be brought in into the ABS negotiations, etc. But I think that question is more general in terms of how do you look at the impact of the declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples in the activities and overall direction of the secretariat of the CBD? Is it really influencing the activities and the programs and the technical cooperation activities that you are doing within the secretariat? And finally, the whole issue of youth, the indigenous youth, how are you also ensuring that the perspectives of the indigenous youth are also incorporated into the work of the secretariat? Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Gracias, señora.
Thank you, Ms. Victoria Tauli. Mr. Scott, could you respond?
Thank you very much for those questions. Yes, the first question was about targeting recommendations that can be effectively implemented by the CBD. And sometimes it's not quite clear exactly who the recommendations are directed at. Of course, a deeper understanding of the structure of a treaty implementation body and the role of secretariats in these bodies always helps to craft technically accurate recommendations, and then we can respond to them and make sure we give you what you want. The interagency support group members are here at the permanent forum, amongst our many other duties, to provide technical advice to the permanent forum members to ensure that recommendations directed at specific agencies are doable and fall within our mandates. If we have recommendations that are not within our mandate, it's impossible for us to respond to those. But it needs to be recalled that political decisions are made by the parties or governments, and we have 193 of those, and specifically at the governing body we refer to as the COP, and political recommendations must be directed at the 193 governments who make the political decisions. The Secretariat is not a political body. We are simply there to fulfil the wishes of the parties. Working groups can make draft recommendations only, and then they send them to the conference of the parties for their consideration. And this brings up the point that Mr. Melzer raised earlier, that was about a report that could it be considered by the working group on ABS. The working group on HA considers all matters related to Indigenous and local communities, and they have to make recommendations to the governing body, and the governing body would then have to direct the working group on ABS. These processes take a minimal of 2 years to do this, because the working groups meet in between the governing body, and the governing body meets every 2 years. So it's important to be familiar with the processes. The Secretariat's work is of a technical nature, such as capacity building. The Secretariat, strictly speaking, is not an implementation body for the Convention. The Convention is implemented at the country level, and the Secretariat does not work at the country level. At the country level, national focal points are appointed by the government, and they are usually found within the Departments of Environment. Also, the Secretariat may only be able to implement decisions if funds are provided by member states. The implementation of many decisions for the Secretariat depends on voluntary donations from the member states. The Secretariat's chief job is to implement the decisions adopted through the consensus of the governing bodies, and hence Indigenous peoples must lobby the member states to ensure favourable and useful decisions are adopted. Of course, the member states have committed to the effective participation of Indigenous peoples, and this allows us to do a lot of work in that area. But the governments report on their responsibilities through their national reports every 4 years, and a summary of these is considered at the Working Group on HA when it meets every 2 years. Now, I'd like to provide a brief example of a recommendation that could have been more finely tuned. The Permanent Forum recommended in 2008 that the Working Group on Access and Benefit Sharing recognise the rights of Indigenous peoples over biological and genetic resources of their own territories. In this particular case, the recommendation would need to be directed at the 193 member states of the governing body, which is the political arm of the convention. Now, of course, I like to be solutions-oriented and to involve agencies in the crafting of recommendations to ensure they are implementable is always a good idea during the permanent forum, and this happens regularly with members. We work closely with the members here. And visits to agencies by permanent forum members of a capacity-building nature so that they learn firsthand about our mandate and the functions and structures also are very useful ways to operate. Of course, it's always a challenge to find resources, but I find it very useful when the members come to visit our agencies, and it's always a great pleasure to have you. The Permanent Forum has a very broad mandate, and it's impossible for individual members to be across everything. So further refining your portfolio system so that Permanent Forum members have a more focused area of particular interest to them and are not overburdened is strongly recommended by the Interagency Support Group. If I could move on to Vicky's second question about the impact of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Now, the Secretariat of the Convention serves the parties, but at the same time it's part of the UN system. As part of the UN system, we have a role in promoting human rights and social justice, but as much as we would like to, particularly on a personal level, we do not have an advocacy mandate. In the same way that the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights does, or that the Permanent Forum itself does. We are an independent facilitator of intergovernmental processes and negotiations, and in these processes we facilitate the effective participation of Indigenous peoples. But decisions regarding the recognition of their rights must be made by the member states of the Convention. Within the Secretariat, I play an active role in raising awareness of Indigenous issues and Indigenous rights, including the Declaration within the Secretariat, with my colleagues, and for the most part, they are very receptive to this. We're made up of about 80 people, and half of those are professional staff, and my colleagues are briefed regularly on Indigenous developments, including the Declaration, and are well aware of the Declaration. Article 8J is a cross-cutting issue. Requires that this is taken into account across all the other program areas dealt with by the Convention. Of course, the current ABS negotiations, which seek to adopt a legally binding protocol in October of this year, are of particular interest to Indigenous peoples. And as I mentioned before, it is the first international law being adopted since the adoption of the Declaration. And as I mentioned before, that even Indigenous peoples themselves are unsure how the Declaration should be mentioned in the preamble of a legally binding protocol. Certainly, there is a growing understanding that the sovereignty of the state is not absolute, and it does provide legitimate governments with the authority to administer their resources. We also have the added complexity that the CBD deals with Indigenous and local communities, and Indigenous peoples have developed a distinct identity in international law that local communities have not. However, we have targeted work coming up with local community representatives, and as local communities are able to develop a distinct identity, this will give more strength to the argument of Indigenous peoples that the phrase Indigenous peoples and local communities should replace Indigenous and local communities. So I think that's a useful strategy. But quite frankly, local communities are about 30 or 40 years behind the Indigenous movement. Final question about Indigenous youth. I should say the Interagency Support Group, which I'm chairing this week in the absence of UN Habitat and UNEP because they were stranded with the volcanic ash, we met with the Indigenous caucuses this morning and we're very pleased that the Indigenous Youth Caucus was there. And we've decided that it was such a useful meeting that we will institutionalise this and meet every year between the Indigenous caucuses and the agencies. And perhaps we could have a longer meeting during one of the closed sessions of the forum. And the Indigenous Youth Caucus have also requested a pre-sessional meeting next year, and the agencies are eager to receive their project proposal so we can look for funding and try and make that reality happen. But I should emphasise, with the voluntary fund for Indigenous participation, we prioritise Indigenous women and youth. In ABS, though, we have given preference to people who are following the process for a long time because the process is at the end of a highly technical legal negotiation. So it's a difficult process to bring new people into. But for our other meetings, we always bring in new people, and we prioritise women and we prioritise youth. In fact, something like 70 to 80% of our participants are Indigenous women, and I'm very pleased about that. Also, for the International Year on Biodiversity, which is this year, we have a special focus in developing community education and public awareness materials, including for Indigenous youth, and these include a short film that is being developed by Indigenous peoples in the South Pacific, an animation being worked on by Indigenous people in Canada, a participation guide which is being developed globally, and community radio stories which are being developed for people in the Amazon and the Andes. So we've got different products for different regions. It was hard to develop a product that could cover every region in the world given the diversity of Indigenous peoples. Thank you for those questions.
Thank you, sir. We invite Ms. Miriam Masakisa from the Ministry of the Natural and Cultural Heritage of Ecuador. Ms. Masakisa, you have the floor. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. The government of Ecuador is committed to the transformation of a liberal state approach to the approach of a state of law and justice, and has been making efforts to ensure that Indigenous peoples and nationalities enjoy the right to self-determination enshrined in Articles 2 and 32 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In addition, the new Constitution of Ecuador incorporates points of great importance for the state of Ecuador because it moves from the pluricultural and multi-ethnic state of the Constitution of 1998 to an intercultural and plurinational state. This reflects one of the most profound and important demands of the Indigenous peoples and nationalities of the country. Another instrument which guides the building of a plurinational and intercultural state geared toward living well is the National Plan for Living Well, a strategic plan that proposes an approach to living well that broadens rights, freedoms, opportunities, and potential of human beings, communities, peoples, and nationalities, and that ensures the recognition of diversity in order to achieve a shared future. In this regard, the national government, through the coordinating Ministry of the Interior, in order to help implement the rights recognized in the Constitution, the National Plan, and the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, has been implementing a development and cultural diversity program financed by the Fund for the Millennium Development Goals, administered by the UNDP. This program coordinates the work of 7 agencies of the UN system and is coordinated by the UN Fund for Population Activities. The program is of national scope and is based in the provinces of Chimborazo, Esmeraldas, and Sucumbíos. It has financing amounting to $5,500,000 over a 3-year period. The program focuses on 3 pillars: the strengthening of intercultural public policy, support for initiatives for cultural and productive revitalization, and capacity building at the national and local planning levels through the production of statistics on cultural and ethnic diversity. The program, in its first year of implementation, has invested $1.4 million for the appreciation of culture, inclusion, intercultural dialogue, and reduction of the inequalities caused by exclusion in the exercise of the rights of peoples and nationalities. Mr. Chairman, Ecuador's constitution, adopted in 2008, establishes that Ecuador is a plurinational and intercultural state that recognizes and guarantees the rights of the authorities of indigenous communities, peoples, and nationalities to exercise jurisdictional functions on the basis of their own traditions and their own law by applying their own norms and procedures. The Ministry of the Interior, with its cultural diversity program, in cooperation with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, has been working on a project to make indigenous law compatible with regular law. I'd like to mention that at the 9th preparatory meeting for this forum, for the permanent forum, the government of Ecuador gathered important recommendations from indigenous peoples and nationalities, and we endorse those proposals. We recommend that the United Nations system support Ecuador in the process of information and reflection with peoples and nationalities on the process of the 10th meeting of the Conference of Parties to be held in Nagoya, Japan in 2010, which will be dealing with questions of access to genetic resources, benefit sharing, and traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples. We recommend to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and to the United Nations system in Ecuador that they coordinate efforts with the Institute for the Eco-Development of the Amazon, the Ecuadorian Amazon region, ECORAI, to organize a meeting of experts in 2011 in our country with the theme, The View of Indigenous Peoples in the Process of Building Indigenous Territorial Constituencies. We recommend that the Program of Development and Cultural Diversity financed by the Fund for the MDG Goals continue into a second phase and broaden its scope in other provinces of our country. Lastly, we recommend to the Technical Interagency Group on Interculturality in Ecuador to continue its efforts for capacity building for the implementation of policies and strategies to achieve sumak kausai, that is, living well, and also that it continue to strengthen the new policies of the Ecuadorian government for peoples and nationalities, and that it continue to harmonize and simplify administrative procedures of the agencies in order efficiently to help implement these new policies. Thank you.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. The next speaker is Ms. Kaia Bue of the International Union for the Preservation of Nature. You have the floor, Ms. Bue.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, enthusiastically joins the UN in celebrating the International Year of Biodiversity. Conserving biodiversity is central to our mission, and our mandate and activities are strongly linked to the Convention on Biological Diversity. We actively support its parties, organs, and the Secretariat in their efforts to ensure that the appropriate decisions are made and that they are implemented as effectively as possible to achieve the CBD objectives. We congratulate the CBD for all the efforts it makes to advance conservation objectives in an inclusive manner and with particular attention to Indigenous peoples and local communities. Just as we face cultural diversity loss due to economic and social changes, the world is continuing to lose its biodiversity at unprecedented rates, and urgent action is needed to ensure the resilience of people and nature. The IUCN Red List of Threatened Species is the most comprehensive and authoritative inventory of the global conservation status of plants and animal species. Many of the world's threatened species remain vital not only for ecosystems, but also for human livelihoods, particularly those of indigenous peoples who so greatly rely on land and natural resources, including plants and animals. IUCN has recently included a new module in its species technical assessment system, focusing on the livelihood and cultural values of species for indigenous peoples and local communities, so that we can also alert about the risks of species decline for the well-being of local people. IUCN recognizes that the traditional knowledge is extremely valuable for identifying, assessing, and monitoring species at risk, as well as for framing appropriate responses to species loss. It is therefore looking forward to further supporting implementation of the CBD in partnership with indigenous peoples who harbor a great reservoir of knowledge and experience about their environments and the species found within them. In line with several articles of the CBD, notably 8J, IUCN works hard to incorporate indigenous issues in all of its work. IUCN supports the CBD negotiations on access and benefit sharing, or ABS, and in particular provides advice to countries and communities on matters related to traditional knowledge associated with genetic resources. IUCN will continue to promote an ABS regime that fully responds to the Convention's objectives, including issues of legal certainty, compliance, and traditional knowledge associated with genetic and biological resources. IUCN is involved in many local capacity building projects throughout the world with the intention of strengthening indigenous and local community institutions to enable just, equitable, and sustainable natural resource governance. This work helps them voice their social, economic, and cultural rights and advocate against unsustainable developments that threaten biodiversity, ecosystems, and the cultures found within them. IUCN will continue to support research on local, social, and economic dynamics to better understand how to implement integrated conservation strategies for environmental and social well-being. Protected areas are one of the most important tools for biodiversity conservation under the CBD, and IUCN is a key partner in implementing the CBD program of work on protected areas. Many protected areas of the world, including marine areas, overlap with lands, territories, and resources of indigenous, traditional, and rural peoples. IUCN recognizes that governance, rights, and participation have historically been weak aspects of protected area management. IUCN will continue to work to ensure due recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples in existing protected areas and the protected areas which may affect indigenous peoples' lands, territories, natural and cultural resources are not established without indigenous peoples' free, prior, and informed consent. To this end, IUCN is actively developing new strategies and supporting new initiatives, such as the Conservation Initiative on Human Rights, created by 8 major international conservation organizations, which incorporate and engage with indigenous peoples to secure their rights and livelihoods. In the context of the CBD Program of Work on Protected Areas, IUCN is also working to promote approaches, tools, and measures to improve protected areas, governance, participation, equity, rights, and livelihoods. Understanding, monitoring, and supporting local participation, governance, livelihoods, and equity indicators place the users of biodiversity back in the equation of successful biodiversity stewardship inside and around protected areas. IUCN will also continue promoting the recognition, respect, and support of Indigenous and local communities' own conservation practices and initiatives, as well as the improvement of local governance systems that enable and support Indigenous peoples to conserve and manage their own environment based on their own rights and responsibilities. IUCN also works directly with the CBD and its Gender Plan of Action to mainstream gender equality and equity in its program initiatives and secure gender-balanced access to resources, control of traditional knowledge, and participation in governance and decision-making. Indigenous women are key holders of knowledge and sustainable practices that IUCN continues to work, and IUCN continues to work towards incorporating their perspectives, needs, and rights into biodiversity and other conservation research and decision-making processes across the world. Mr. Chairman, IUCN reaffirms its commitment to continue working hard to safeguard and promote Indigenous peoples' rights and interests in its mission to conserve biodiversity and looks forward to further collaboration and partnership with CBD parties, organs, and secretariat, as well as with Indigenous peoples' organizations in this endeavor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Muchas gracias, señor, por...
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the interpreters for their efforts. Mr. Youssef, you have the floor, and I'd like to ask you also to be aware of the time constraints.
Señor Lacerdas?
Mr. Lacerdas has the floor.
No está en sala, ¿no?
Son viendo dónde es.
No está el señor de UNICEF. Vamos a.
Gentleman from UNICEF is not here, so we'll give the floor to Mr. Hiten Dunam of the Asia Caucus. Mr. Yumnam, could you ask questions, please?
I would like to speak on behalf of the Asian Caucus, and I would like to raise some questions with regard to the upcoming COP of CBD in Nagoya, and also on the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and also on the implementation of integration of the recognition of the pre-prior informed consent, and also in other concerns. First, I would like to ask CBD as to what step has been taken up to ensure that the traditional knowledge is created as a cross-cutting team for the new CBD strategic plan and for the post 2010 biodiversity targets. And for the central role of the indigenous peoples, to ensure the central role of indigenous peoples in the implementation. Yeah, and because we also hope that there is a partnership to promote the communication, education and public awareness programs on biological and cultural diversity just to be carried out with UN agencies, government, with a full participation of indigenous peoples. And I would like also to ask, it's already been addressed, but I would like to ask if what step has been taken to fully integrate the provisions of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples alongside with the implementation of the new strategic plan and in the post 2010 biodiversity targets, and also in the monitoring of the state of traditional knowledge and community well-being. And I would like to ask the CBDs also to what step has been taken up to strengthen the recognition and implementation of the pre-prior and informed consent of indigenous peoples in the activities of CBD. And also we hope that the proposed protocol on the access and benefit sharing must recognize the indigenous peoples' inherent right to our resources as outlined in the UN DRIP, Declaration of Indigenous Peoples, and to ensure respect for the indigenous peoples' governance system, our customary laws, institutions and procedures at the local level. And also, I would like to ask CBD what steps have been taken up to develop a clear-cut indicators for assessing the full implementation of the recommendations of CBD for the protection of biodiversity in indigenous peoples' land and territories. We have raised several recommendations, and I'm going to submit it for your kind perusal. And I would like to also to recommend a couple of points. Like, we'd like to urge the parties to all CBD to stop all support of the agrofoil monoculture plantation, genetically modified organisms, construction of dams, mega dams, extractive industries, creation of protected areas, which has been carried out without the free prior informed consent of the of indigenous peoples, and also that destroy the biodiversity and source of the physical and spiritual survival of our peoples. And I would also like to urge upon the CBD to strengthen support for initiatives of indigenous peoples and local communities, including the greater allocation of finances in support of the community projects. And at the same time, to ensure that safeguard be applied to ensure that funding by Global Environment Facility and large conservation NGOs do not bring negative impact on indigenous peoples. And we also urge to ask the use of the AQUICON guidelines in the conduct of the related socio-economic and cultural impact assessment, sir. I'm submitting the recommendations for your kind perusal again, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
Gracias, señor.
Thank you, sir. I give the floor to Mr. Indu Ibrahim of the Africa Caucus. Mr. Ibrahim, you have the floor.
Señor Ibrahim, puede.
Mr. Ibrahim, could you raise your hand if you're in the hall?
Yeah, just move over.
La próxima.
The next speaker on the list is Ms. Deborah Haring of the Global Caucus. Ms. Haring, you have the floor.
¿Está la señora Haring? ¿Puede?
Is Ms. Haring in the hall? You have the floor for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, colleagues. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present this statement on behalf of the Global Indigenous Caucus and our comments to the we direct our comments to the permanent forum members and to the parties of the Convention of the Biological Diversity through the Secretariat. This intervention addresses the international regime on access and benefit sharing, currently being elaborated and negotiated under the auspices of the CBD. We were pleased to hear the Executive Secretary of the CBD acknowledge that Indigenous peoples are indeed owners of the land, which he said on the first day of the opening of this forum. Let me go first to our recommendations. First, that the UN, the Permanent Forum recommend that the CBD recognize the direct relevance of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples regarding any future international protocol on access and benefit sharing, and provide recognition of the rights of Indigenous peoples to protect the biological materials, genetic resources, and traditional knowledge originating from our lands and territories. We hope that the parties will do this by ensuring the following preambular text is included in the protocol. 1. Recognizing that the importance of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the principles enshrined in it, including Indigenous free, prior, and informed consent, are included in the protocol. Also, to recognize that traditional knowledge and associated genetic resources are best protected in and through the exercise of the inherent rights of Indigenous peoples. We remind the parties of the convention that, consistent with international human rights law, states have an obligation to recognize and protect the rights of Indigenous peoples, to control access to the genetic resources that originate in our lands and territories and waters. Such recognition must be a key element of the proposed international regime on access and benefit sharing. We recommend that the parties use the term Indigenous peoples and local communities, consistent with current international standards, and also that they include clear and explicit inclusion or reference to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Global Caucus wishes to express our concern that in the event that if the parties do not include specific reference to the rights of Indigenous peoples and express a willingness and commitment to protect our rights, that the Global Caucus must unequivocally reject the outcomes of the negotiated text of the International Protocol on Access and Benefit Sharing as not being sufficiently protective of the rights of Indigenous peoples. We ask that the Secretariat of the Convention transmit this communication to the parties as an information document, and I will submit the full text of our statement to the Secretariat. During this time, I would just like to highlight some of our key concerns. We know that this international regime creates a situation of conflicting sovereignties because states are asserting national sovereignty over genetic resources, but failing to recognize that Indigenous peoples also have permanent sovereignty over genetic resources, and that the states have been unwilling to recognize that in the text of their regime. This will create a situation that potentially may create the risk of further exploitation and theft of Indigenous peoples' genetic resources, plant genetic resources, flora and fauna around us, and put it at further risk and exploitation. State sovereignty cannot be asserted to an extent that derogates the sovereignty and internationally recognized rights of Indigenous peoples over our natural resources, including genetic resources. We're very concerned. What will it take to get the parties to take Indigenous rights seriously at this late stage in the negotiation of the international protocol? In the event that the states cannot take indigenous rights seriously, the Global Indigenous Caucus would reject a protocol that does not recognize or diminishes our internationally recognized rights as indigenous peoples. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Damos la palabra al...
I give the floor to Mr. Danilo de Jesus Lacerdas of UNICEF. Mr. Lacerdas, please.
Tiene la palabra, por favor, señor.
Sir, you have the floor.
Ingenio Anto.
Tiene la palabra.
You have the floor.
Petón costume a Urapina Patasho.
My name is Urapina Patasho. Good morning to all of you. I'm 15 years old and I'm Brazilian. I'm from the Coroa Vermelha Patasho village in Santa Cruz, Cabralia, state of Bahia. I'm a citizenship agent, promoting a better life for indigenous children and adolescents within my community. We, better than anyone, know our history and our reality well. Our main goal is to contribute to the discussion of issues that affect our lives. So I'm grateful for the opportunity that UNICEF has given us to attend this prestigious UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. I'm here today at the UN as a representative of my people to say what can be done to guarantee our rights, especially those of children and adolescents. We're following the development of the world, and as part of it, we want to participate in this process as equals. We want the full implementation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, taking into account the particularities of indigenous communities. We want to secure our right to our land, because without it, we cannot have health, education, leisure, play areas, and therefore we cannot fully live our lives. When lands are not defined and assigned to our people, the government won't build schools, clinics, parks, and sports fields. It is from the land that we take our food, our rituals, that we build our history. We want an education that will contribute to the ending of the discrimination against indigenous peoples. We want education for the promotion and respect of our culture, language, rituals, and traditional knowledge. We want all educational textbooks to tell the real history of indigenous peoples, of our struggle and resistance against colonization, the massacres we've suffered, and our fight to maintain our history. In addition, we would like to have teachers that are better prepared and that respect our differences. We want to secure the right to fight for our rights and that our peaceful struggle be respected. We constantly lose our leaders due to the struggle. Our leaders are our greatest inspiration. They have always fought so that our culture can survive. We learn from them, and we want to take our culture forward. We want to help end the violence against children and adolescents. We are seeking entities that can identify and act against people who have committed acts of violence, such as sexual exploitation and abuse, domestic violence, kidnapping and trafficking of children. Many children and teenagers in my village have to sell handicrafts on the beach, and in doing so, they're exposed to suffering and to violence at the hands of tourists. We want support for the creation of jobs and income for families so that there is no need for child labor. Children, adolescents, and youth in my village, including myself, are doing our part in raising awareness among children and adolescents about the risks to which they are exposed. We've produced signs, made speeches, conducted debates in schools. We have marched through the main streets of the city and host plays in the village cultural center. We want all children and adolescents to be aware and to know how to protect themselves. We also talk with families in order to raise awareness about their children's needs. We hope that our voice is really heard and acted upon through concrete deeds. I do not want the memory of having had an ornamental role at this event. We trust the leaders here today and at the UN. We hope that our recommendations will be forwarded. I commend the Permanent Forum for opening a space for adolescents to be heard. I feel honored to participate in an event of such importance. Thank you.
Muchas gracias. Vamos a...
Thank you. We'll ask Mr. Scott to make a brief statement in response to comments made. Mr. Scott.
In finishing, I'd just like to thank our chair and our secretary here for helping us to try and make this a flexible dialogue and recognize Miriam Masekisa. It's nice to see a young Indigenous woman representing a government. She was instrumental in setting up the secretariat for the Permanent Forum, and now she's representing the government of Ecuador at this meeting. With regards to the Asian Caucus, of course I'm here to... There's a long list of questions, and I'm here to have a dialogue with you. Regarding the statement from the Global Caucus, I would caution you to respect the Global Caucus of Indigenous Peoples who follow the CBD. And, of course, you're welcome to submit statements, position papers directly to the CBD. There would be a procedural issue if position papers were being submitted to the Permanent Forum because the members would have to adopt it by consensus and then pass it on to us. So I would just remind you that, of course, you're welcome to participate in the CBD, but the Global Caucus at the Permanent Forum should also respect the Global Caucus of Indigenous Peoples at the CBD and to work closely with them to ensure that you're on common ground in pursuing Indigenous rights in the ABS negotiation. I would also point out that the member states, in fact, take Indigenous peoples' rights very seriously, and that's why we're in a long, protracted negotiation, because it's a difficult issue to arrive at consensus on. So I wouldn't misportray them as not taking it seriously. In fact, the reason it's a long, protracted negotiation is because they're taking these matters very seriously indeed, and they're yet to arrive at consensus on this. So it's important that both bodies respect each other's processes, and also the Indigenous caucuses at both bodies should respect each other. So I would like to finish by thanking everybody in the room for ensuring that we had a dialogue this morning, and I hope that the idea of the dialogue can continue to evolve to be a flexible discussion between agencies and Indigenous peoples. Thank you.
Gracias, señor Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Thank you, Ms. Lopez. We shall now proceed with the next part of Agenda Item 6, namely the annual report of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues. And I give the floor to Ms. Yamina Jacta, the Deputy Director of the UN Habitat New York Office. Ms. Jacta, if you could join us on the podium.
Doy la palabra a la señora.
Ms. Yamina Jacta has the floor. She will present the annual report of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it working?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mr. Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, distinguished Indigenous representatives, distinguished delegates, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, dear Ms. Elsa Stamatopoulou and team of the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, UN Habitat, as the current co-chair of the Interagency Support Group, has the honor to address the Permanent Forum at its 9th session today to report back on the last annual meeting of the Interagency Support Group, which was held in Nairobi, Kenya, between the 28th and the 30th September 2009, on behalf of both chairs, UNEP and UN Habitat. We would like to take this opportunity to thank all colleagues who are member of the IASG, which stands for Interagency Support Group, for their continuous support and for having been able to come and be part of the last annual IASG meeting in Nairobi. It has been a pleasure and a productive learning experience to act as co-chairs this past year and to learn from colleagues throughout the UN system regarding Indigenous peoples' issues. As chairs, it has been a particular delight to work closer with the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, its chair, and her team members. Having commonly decided to give the Nairobi meeting an African focus, which was highly supported by the IASG team, also during the preparations towards the 3 days meeting, we were particularly honored by the good representation of African Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues members who came to Nairobi on this occasion. In reflection to the official visit of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues members to UNEP and UN Habitat, both organizations would like to express their deep gratitude to the distinguished members of the forum, Ms. Margaret Lokowa, Ms. Liliane Mbele Muzangi, Mr. Hassan Id Balkasem, as well as Mr. Lars Anders Baer, for their coming to Nairobi and their relevant support and contribution throughout the IASG meeting, as well as their official visits to UNEP and UN Habitat relevant offices. The participation and preparation of our office colleagues in the Nairobi headquarters towards the IASG meetings, as well as the focused discussion of some of our offices with the members, have helped to mainstream Indigenous issues in our programs, reorient certain themes and topics relevant to Indigenous people in both organizations, and to improve the understanding of the topic as well. The co-chairs would like to specifically thank UNESCO, who was the outgoing chair of the IASG, for their continuous support and efforts, as well as their excellent work towards consolidating the common IASG discussion paper on development with culture and identity, which was presented on Monday this week to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. During the first day of the IASG annual meeting last September, a panel discussion was held on the situation of Indigenous people's rights in Africa. Presenters from the African Commission on Human and People's Rights introduced the challenge of defining Indigenous people's issues in Africa. The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights was also invited to speak about best practices, experiences, lessons learned, and challenges concerning the implementation of Indigenous people's rights in Africa. Mr. Hassan Id Belkacem, member of the Permanent Forum, gave a presentation on the progress made in recognizing the rights of Indigenous people in Africa. invited indigenous peoples' representatives from Kenya and the region, gave a snapshot and examples over the main concern of indigenous people in Africa. It was then felt that there was a need to move from the mainstreaming of indigenous peoples' issues to a program dedicated to indigenous peoples that would bring the various agencies working on their behalf together. It was stressed that the United Nations are well placed to help indigenous peoples to engage constructively with their governments. In addition, presenters insisted on the need for significant investment in capacity building for indigenous peoples to ensure that they understand their rights, proposed programs, matters of economy, and culturally appropriate and adequate alternative livelihoods options. In the discussion, indigenous representatives raised a number of issues, in particular on land use, noting the increased commercial pressure on land and resulting evictions. Responding to the comments, the panelists agreed that the African Commission on Human and People's Rights should consider the issue of land development, in particular in Africa. Another representative endorsed the difficulties described by other representatives when dealing with indigenous peoples in Africa, in particular, identifying projects involving indigenous people when they were not recognized as such by governments. She proposed that the IASG should draw up a list of recommendations on how to identify indigenous peoples' issues in Africa and implement policies related to them based on more country-level data and consultation with indigenous peoples themselves. The constitutional and legislative protection of the rights of indigenous people was also discussed. An ILO introduced an overview report of the research project by ILO and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights on constitutional and legislative protection of the right of indigenous peoples in 24 African states. The available mechanism for indigenous people in Kenya in order to address concerns with regard to evictions, land dispossession, conflicts between nomadic communities and ranch owners, and dispossession in favor of multinational investment was also discussed. Furthermore, case studies on the indigenous people in the context of climate change, pastoralism, and security and mobility were presented by Kenyan-based indigenous peoples organizations, UN organizations, as well as non-governmental organizations. As a special invitee to the IASG annual meeting, the resident coordinator for Kenya addressed the meeting on ways to establish mechanisms for engagement and communication with indigenous peoples so that their participation in United Nations processes such as the Common Country Assessment and the United Nations Development Assistance Framework, any project formulation and implementation could be institutionalized, thereby ensuring transparency and inclusion. He also committed to provide the United Nations country team in Kenya with a special training on indigenous peoples with the support of the Permanent Forum. Following his statement, the IASG directed the following recommendation to the United Nations country team in Kenya, namely, a country-level task force on indigenous peoples' issue in Kenya, coordinated and supported by the country team, should be established to follow up the recommendation of the present report and liaise with the group and the secretariat of the Permanent Forum on the possibility of organizing a training session on indigenous peoples' issue for the country team in Kenya. We are happy to announce that the UN country team in Kenya has followed the recommendation from the IASG to the UN country team Kenya, as reflected in the final report, and initiated actions towards the planning of a relevant training for the team. Currently, a task force comprised by the Resident Coordinator's Office, UNDP, OHCHR, IOM, UN Habitat, and UNEP are developing an outreach strategy to already existing outcome working groups within the team, within the UN country team. The collaboration with these working groups will enhance the support and ensure the embedment of the team on indigenous people in already existing working groups to ensure a durable and sustainable approach on indigenous people's issue. The current task force was set up earlier this year, is therefore engaging the outcome working groups in the design of the training and discussion with them, have been initiated with the objective of an effective and sustainable mainstreaming of Indigenous peoples' issue into the United Nations programming such as UNDAF, which is the United Nations Development Assistance Framework. The recent cases regarding Indigenous peoples in Kenya include the Ondorois people from Lake Baringo, who were successful in reclaiming their land back from the government of Kenya, as well as the Ogik Elders Council of the Mau Forest, which was established a few weeks ago to collaborate with the Kenyan government and make their concerns and needs as Indigenous peoples heard. These two examples show that there is not only a need to address Indigenous peoples' issue in Kenya through a one-time-off training of technical staff, but to ensure the sustainability of a coordinated and well-informed, as well as participatory and transparent approach from the United Nations agencies and their partners, with particular focus on the government. In its annual meeting, the IASG engaged in a very successful dialogue and discussions and made a number of recommendations. These discussions include interagency support groups' feedback on the new structure of the in-depth dialogues and recommended to invite interested member states, United Nations country teams, as well as regional IASGs to also present their work into the in-depth dialogues. Country teams, for example, could be invited to explain the programming processes, themes, priorities, and other matters regarding Indigenous issues at country level and to answer questions. This recommendation was well received by the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum and by the Permanent Forum members. Another recommendation was made by the group of the IASG is to look into the option of a communication platform to consider more effective methods of communication, information sharing, and coordination among the members of the support group. We are working on the follow-up and implementation of the recommendation. And in fact, this morning at the interagency support group meeting, we started with the technical discussion on it. It was also recommended to identify entry points, potential synergies, and opportunities to mainstream Indigenous peoples' issues in country programming. For instance, activities on Indigenous peoples' issues could be undertaken within the framework of existing initiatives and projects, such as programs aimed at supporting the capacity of civil society and Indigenous peoples' organizations, for example, the Global Environmental Facility Small Grant Programs implemented by the UNDP or the UNDP Civil Society Democratic Governance Facilities implemented in Kenya and others. While it's clear that not all UN agencies and programs have the capacity to work on specific country-level projects, it should be possible to establish cooperation at both country and global levels. UN agencies and programs might need to join forces not only in the area of funding, but also in those of human resources and expertise. In that regard, UNDP suggested to explore setting up mechanisms such as a knowledge network
to share practices among colleagues from UN agencies and other relevant partners working at the local, regional, or global levels. A knowledge network can evolve into a community of practitioners working on indigenous peoples' issues as a platform for better communication and coordination, involving people working on and committed to the same issues, including permanent forum members. The IASG also recommended that its members collaborate with the working group of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to further identify and explore strategies to promote the implementation of indigenous peoples' rights in the African region. Finally, the interagency support group engaged in interesting discussions about the challenges within the United Nations, agencies and programs in developing and implementing guidelines, strategies or policies pertaining to indigenous peoples. Examples were given by the World Bank and IFAD, who introduced its recently adopted policy on engagement with indigenous peoples, as well as UN Habitat, which presented its policy guide to housing for indigenous peoples in cities. Please do refer for the further issues and highlights brought to the support group meeting to the detailed report of the annual IASG meeting, as well as its annex, which is a compilation of all the thematic issues discussed. Both are available on the Permanent Forum website. It has been a stimulating, interesting, and very positive experience for UNEP and UN Habitat to act as the IASG co-chairs for the first time in the IASG's history. The co-chairs feel that there are mutual benefits to enhance cooperation on indigenous peoples and will endeavor towards the development of common projects ideas at global and regional levels in the area of climate change mitigation and adaptation, in particular in the Arctic region and in the context of urban and sustainable urbanization. UNEP and UN Habitat and the entire support group are ready to stand by WHO to successfully host the next annual meeting scheduled to take place in Geneva from the 15th to the 17th September 2010. WHO is a key organization in the work on indigenous peoples' issue, and the ISG is looking forward to working on indigenous peoples' health issues and including topics relevant to all the organization. I would like to take this opportunity on behalf of the Interagency Support Group, the Chief of the Secretariat on the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, Mrs. Elsa Stamatopoulou, for her continuous support and excellent leadership, not only in the last year, but since the existence of the Permanent Forum. It is certainly also thanks to her that the Interagency Support Group has been able to follow its ambitions over the years in the name of indigenous peoples worldwide. I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias, señora Dajta.
Thank you, Ms. Jagta. The Permanent Forum is grateful for the constant support that we receive from the Interagency Support Group. The commitment of all of the agencies and funds of the UN through your work in implementing the Declaration on the Human Rights of the Indigenous Peoples is very important to us. And also the work that you're doing in drafting guidelines on the indigenous peoples. I also want to say how grateful I am because your work supports our peoples in all our countries and makes it more possible for the indigenous peoples to be part of the process here in the United Nations, as Mr. Ban Ki-moon already said. We'd like to encourage the observers from the indigenous organizations to address the interagency support group on indigenous issues so that you can have dialogues, meetings, and improve the work of the country teams in our countries, because we, the indigenous peoples, certainly find it difficult to get access to the country teams and to the different agencies in our individual countries. So this is very important work. Thank you very much, Ms. Jagta. Thank you for being here with us.
Vamos a pasar al tema cuatro.
We'll turn to item four. We're going to go back to item four and open our list of speakers. The first speaker on our list will be Ms. Dora Tavera of the Colombian Indigenous Organization. Is Ms. Tavera here in the room?
Levante la mano.
Could you raise your hand, please? You have the floor. Ms. Tavera, you have the floor. Please, could I be next on the list? Maria Nuskuhur. From India, please. Ms. Kuhur. Is Ms. Kuhur in the hall? You have the floor.
Hello. Hello.
Tiene la palabra.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and distinguished indigenous representatives, let me first congratulate Mr. Carlos Mamami for being elected to the chair and express my thanks to Madam Victoria for her efficient leadership during the last 5 years. The context of Adivasis in India today is the context of an adverse impact of economic liberalization accelerated by the process of globalization, which is marked by profound changes, acute conflicts, and new possibilities. Taken as a whole, the situation of Adivasis in India today looks like a bundle of paradoxes. The government of India does not recognize the existence of indigenous peoples in India, but we Adivasis categorically assert that we are indigenous peoples and we do exist. The constitutional category under which Adivasis, tribals, indigenous groups are enumerated is called Scheduled Tribes. More than 92% live in rural areas. Ironically, many of the Adivasis scheduled as tribes in one state are not recognized as scheduled tribes in other states within India. In some states, there are many irregularities in the census of the Adivasis. Mr. Chairman, an official database of persons displaced by projects is not available. However, some unofficial studies peg this figure at around 60 million for the period between 1947 to 2004. And of the total displaced, 40% and more are tribals. And the total percentage of people resettled is only 24. Mr. Chairman, large-scale human rights violations, crimes and atrocities have been perpetuated against the tribals in the rural areas. These pertain to civil rights, economic rights, social rights, and political rights. The most outraging part of the gross human rights violation is that there is social, cultural, and physical annihilation of the tribals in the states of Chhattisgarh, Orissa, Madhya Pradesh, West Bengal, and Jharkhand, despite legislations to protect them. It appears as if there is a war on people, primarily on tribals, in the name of countering the so-called terrorists or extremists. However, in the above-mentioned states, it looks as if war zones are deliberately created so that people are forced to take to arms, thereby being prone to be labeled as extremists, Maoists, and anti-development, so that they can be eliminated by the vested interests to pave the way for private companies to acquire the land inhabited by the tribals. This has proved to be one of the effective ways of dealing with the tribal resistance to the acquisition of their land and other natural resources. In Dantewada district of Chhattisgarh, more than 300 villages have become uninhabited due to the militarization of the area. In the state of Chhattisgarh, anti-Adivasi program known as Salva Judum is going on for the last few years, which ironically means peace movement. Mr. Chairman, here are a few recommendations for the UN intervention to the betterment of the tribals: that the UN bodies pressurize the government of India to recognize the existence of indigenous peoples in India; that the UN bodies do not encourage funding for the development projects that adversely impact Adivasis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Señora Dora Tavera.
Ms. Dora Tavera of Colombia.
Gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you. My name is Dora Tavera. I'm from the UNIC, the Indigenous National Organization of Colombia. And we are speaking on behalf of the South American Region Organization. We'd like to express thanks for the voluntary contributions made to the UN fund that made it possible for us to participate in this session. We express our concern at the situation of indigenous peoples in South America. Through the media, we know that there's a persecution of leaders who fight against violations of human rights. There are concessions for mega projects exploiting our oil resources. There are violations of the fundamental rights of indigenous peoples to ensure their future and their culture. While we support the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, municipalities, local governments are not aware of its contents and its implications. And so there's a systematic violation of the rights of our peoples. There are displacements in Colombia. There are cases of the mines in Argentina. In Colombia in 2009, 114 indigenous persons were murdered. That's an increase of 63% over 2008. That same year, the Constitutional Court decided that at least 34 indigenous peoples were at risk of physical and cultural disappearance. Nonetheless, for UNIC, we see many more populations at risk, many more than are included on the list of the court. It should be clarified that the decisions of the Constitutional Court have not yet been implemented, such as 004 and 92 of 2008 on the protection of women, and in particular indigenous women. Not only has there been non-compliance, on the contrary, violations of the rights of indigenous peoples have increased significantly in spite of the above-mentioned legislation. Furthermore, the UN declarations in its Article 10 enshrines the right not to be displaced from our lands and territories. Nonetheless, between 2002 and 2008, over 70,000 people were displaced, and in 2009, 6,200 indigenous persons were expelled violently from their traditional lands. 80% of our territory has been given as a concession for economic projects. And in September of 2009, the Colombian government decided that colonial preserves over 100 years old no longer exist. There are transnational corporations that exploit mining, wood, oil resources and that exploit water resources without consultation and without prior free consent of the indigenous peoples. Public policies and state policies in general are imposed from above without taking into account the demands, the proposals of indigenous peoples, of their women and youth. For our coming generations, it is a challenge to have the right to intercultural education of high quality and health on the basis of our own world view and the affirmation of our cultural identity free of discrimination. In Argentina, for example, the indigenous peoples are at a high risk . Their human rights are violated and they lose their lives because of their fight in defense of their land. The neoliberal model prevails. We urge states to be consistent with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and on Convention 169 by implementing specific proposals, by harmonizing the Declaration with national legislation, with the declaration being the basic framework. We encourage training programs for youth on development with cultural identity. We ask that the demands and proposals of the indigenous peoples be taken into account with mechanisms for effective participation in decision-making, that the rights of indigenous peoples to their ancestral lands be protected, and that there be consultation mechanisms in the framework of ILO 169. This is necessary so that all of these rights can be exercised with the full participation of indigenous peoples. It must be taken into account that many indigenous peoples are at risk of physical and cultural extinction, and that many have disappeared. So the permanent forum should study the possibility of considering this as a special theme in one of its future sessions. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, we hope that states and responsible entities will make steady progress in recognizing and respecting the rights of the indigenous peoples at the national and international levels by complying with commitments undertaken at the international level. Thank you. Thank you. Next on our list is Mr. Roderick Dillon, who will speak on behalf of a number of indigenous organizations. Mr. Dillon, you have the floor.
¿Puede levantar la mano, señor?
Could you raise your hand, please, Mr. Dillon? No. It seems he's not here. So we give the floor to Mr. Salomon Albarnach of the Organization for the Development of the Peruvian Forest. You have the floor, sir.
Levantar la mano.
Sir, could you raise your hand? Mr. Abanac? Is Mr. Abanac in the hall? You have the floor.
Distinguidos miembros.
Distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, on behalf of the Interethnic Organization Development of the Amazonian Forest, in implementation of the right to self-determination contained in the United Nations Declaration on the Right of Indigenous Peoples, we want to say the following. First, in its annual report, our people state that in Peru there are 252 conflicts, out of which 40% are socio-environmental conflicts, and a majority of them are caused by extractive activities on the territory of indigenous peoples. This is with disregard for the principle of prior informed consent, and our priorities for development have not been taken into account. And this resulted in the regrettable events of Bagua in 2009. Second, Convention 169 of the ILO has been in force for 15 years. And many years after the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, the Peruvian government has not complied properly with these international instruments. There are few policies for Indigenous peoples that include the right to consultation, respect for cultural identity, our right to development with cultural identity. Third, in Peru, the development of the Peruvian Amazon has been characterized by a trend to give concessions for extractive activities. 70% of our Amazon has been cut down for the oil industry. And this is often lands that belong to indigenous peoples, leading to violations of our fundamental rights. Fourth, in Peru, the right to consultation, together with our right to development and self-determination, are in a phase of negotiations. And in this regard, it's important to ensure that the proposal of Andean Amazonian organizations be taken into account by the Congress of the Republic, and that in this way we achieve the implementation of our right to be consulted in accordance with ILO 169 and the UN Declaration. Therefore, there can be no legislation enacted under these standards, as has been occurring in the discussion in the Congress of the Republic. Fifth, in this process, it is vital that Peru promptly ensure, and with the participation of we the peoples, genuine institutionality so that the indigenous people can help the implementation of policies for development with identity. Sixth, we urge the state of Peru to make every effort to ensure that members of the permanent forum can make an official visit to Peru, as was the case in Bolivia and Paraguay. This will help to assess compliance with the rights of indigenous peoples in Peru, and it will generate better channels of dialogue between the state and we, the indigenous peoples. It is for this reason, and through the distinguished members of the Permanent Forum and the international community, that we reaffirm our commitment to development with respect for the environment and our preparedness for dialogue based on good faith. In this regard, we urge Peru promptly to implement, and in participation with and consultation with the indigenous peoples, policies that ensure our cultural identity, our development, and our self-determination. Thank you, sir.
Señor.
Thank you. And we move on with a list of speakers. Representatives of government. And again, we ask you to be understanding in our use of time. Ms. Gabriela Garduño of Mexico has the floor. Ms. Gabriela Garduño of Mexico. Thank you very much. The Mexican government is completely committed to promoting the exercise of the rights contained in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in the daily lives of our population. As part of the Program for the Development of Indigenous Peoples, 2009 to 2012, mentioned in my last statement, Pillar 1 on Indigenous Rights seeks to promote, in terms of applicable provisions, the harmonization of the legal framework regarding indigenous rights, and to create conditions for the respect and full exercise of those rights. The National Program of Human Rights, 2008 to 2012, also contains different actions to promote, in a cross-cutting fashion, the exercise of the rights of the indigenous peoples, including enhancing compliance with international instruments that enshrine the rights of indigenous peoples, preventing discrimination in the field of labor and in education, and promoting respect for cultural diversity. Following adoption of the declaration, in Mexico, different actions have been taken that seek to disseminate the declaration through the indigenous cultural broadcasting system of the National Commission for the Development of Indigenous Peoples, the CDI, there are information capsules transmitted on the contents of the declaration. A pocket edition of the declaration has been published in Spanish, and this was distributed to civil servants and to members of the indigenous peoples. The declaration has been translated into 18 indigenous languages in a coordinated effort with the offices of the UNDP, the UN Information Center, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, as well as the Indigenous Fund. These translations are being disseminated through different means, and they can be found on the internet websites of project participants. In close cooperation with UNDP, we have distributed translations of the declaration and combined that with workshops to train indigenous peoples and communities, training workshops. During the presentation of the first report on the situation of indigenous peoples in Mexico, on 14 January, the Mexican government highlighted the importance of the implementation of the declaration and indicated that consultation and participation by indigenous peoples and communities should be the focal points that define their own development, as is established in Articles 18 and 19. Likewise, we showed a short film, Sabina's Path, as a joint effort to promote the rights of indigenous peoples in the framework of this declaration. Other innovative means have been found to reach out to a larger number of indigenous communities, including producing paper for wrapping tortillas that contain the text in Maya and in Spanish of the rights of indigenous women. You can find in the hall examples of this paper and a more detailed explanation of the project. In summary, we're convinced in Mexico that there's a need for indigenous communities and peoples to be aware of their own rights as a necessary step toward their exercising those rights fully. Mr. Chairman, Article 7 of the Declaration recognizes that indigenous persons have the right to life, to physical and mental integrity, to freedom and security, and the right to be protected from any type of violence. One of the new forms of violence affecting our society is the trafficking in persons. On the 14th of April, at the invitation of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, Mexico became a platform for launching in Latin America the Blue Heart campaign against trafficking in persons. This crime is viewed as a modern form of slavery, which includes kidnapping, transport, transfer, the reception of persons, use of force or other forms of coercion. This exploitation has as its objective the different forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor or forced services, slavery, or similar practices. Indigenous peoples are particularly vulnerable to the different forms of the crime of trafficking, and for this reason, the Mexican government will be working in 2010 and 2011 with 62 indigenous peoples in order to raise the awareness of the existence of this crime and of forms of prevention and complaint through massive dissemination of materials adapted to the indigenous reality in their languages, using their own methods, and in their communities. Mr. Chairman, the rights that are contained in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples are part of an international trend in this field and guide states in harmonizing their own legal frameworks and in designing and implementing public policies that lead to complete implementation. In Mexico, we shall continue to work toward this objective. Thank you.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Ms. Conye Taracena from the Permanent Mission of Guatemala to the United Nations. You have the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is on item 4. We would have liked to have made this statement when the special rapporteur was with us in the hall. Nonetheless, my delegation does want to say that it's a source of pride for us to see someone from our region presiding over the 9th session of the forum. We wish you every success in your work. Please be assured of Guatemala's success for the work we do on the agenda we've adopted. We also extend our best wishes to the other members of the forum. We want to take this opportunity to express thanks for the fine work done by Vicky Tauli Corpus as chair of the last 5 forums. My government reiterates its conviction that in order to obtain enjoyment of the human rights and fundamental freedoms of indigenous peoples, it is essential to eliminate racism, discrimination, and all forms of intolerance. We reiterate our determination to promote conditions of equality in civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights with full respect for the distinct characteristics and initiatives of the indigenous peoples so that they can freely express their own identity and be an inherent part of the community life of the nation. We recognize the urgent need to take measures to fight against the persistence of racial, social, and cultural discrimination. We're aware of the value and the cultural diversity that the indigenous peoples contribute to the universal heritage of humankind, and we recognize that their active participation in all societies is fundamental in consolidating the political and social stability of the states where they reside. We want to congratulate the forum for having chosen as the theme of this session development with culture and identity. This is a topic of the meeting that was held in January of this year, and it shows the application of an economic model of development that respects the cultural, political, social, ecological, and economic integrity of the indigenous peoples and their communities. Under the rule of law, my government promotes the development of culture and identity of the indigenous peoples. And in the past 5 years, 14 actions have been undertaken in the framework of public policies, plans, projects, and actions. We would like to highlight the following. A, the promotion of social investment programs with ethnic and cultural relevance that promote equality of opportunity. B, the strengthening of mechanisms for participation contained in the law of decentralization and in the law and regulation of the urban and rural development councils. C, dissemination and promotion of the traditions and cultural customs of the indigenous peoples and the strengthening of bilingual education, as well as promotion of legislation to eradicate discrimination. D, incorporation of medicinal practices of the indigenous peoples in state health services. E, evaluation of policies, strategies, programs, and plans for rural development related to poverty in order to ensure their ethnic, cultural, and gender relevance. We also have with us the women's advocate representative. We reiterate our resolute support for public policy for the coexistence and elimination of racial discrimination and racism. This policy represents the collective effort of public and social institutions, social scientists, activists, and organized citizens that are concerned to eradicate the problem of racism, convinced that Guatemalan society and the Guatemalan state can move from exclusion and discrimination to a state characterized by pluralism and democracy. We also have pending approval in Congress the following laws: Law of the Sacred Places of the Maya, the Law of Consultation with Indigenous Peoples, the Law on Community Radio, the General Law on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Law of the National Program of Compensation, and the Law for Bilingual, Multicultural, and Intercultural Education. During the last two administrations, we strengthened the role of the Interinstitutional Indigenous Coordinator of the state, and this is an umbrella for Indigenous mechanisms. This year, the government presented information on the follow-up on recommendations from the session of the 8th Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in document EC19/2010/12/Addendum 8, which contains more detailed information on the status of Indigenous peoples in Guatemala. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, my delegation wishes to reaffirm its support for the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues so that it may fulfill its objectives and the Millennium Development Goals. To the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples, who is invited to visit the country in June, and our support for implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you.
Gracias por sus palabras.
Thank you, madam. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Alvin Saleh of the Mayaskar Alliance of Indonesia. Mr. Saleh, you have the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. This statement is endorsed by 26 organizations. Chairperson, I would like to use this opportunity to draw your attention to the situation of Indigenous people in my homeland, North Sumatra, in Maroke, West Papua. In my homeland, there was an arrest last year, and there has been a continued threat of arrest of Indigenous leaders for defending our land and territory by police and the state plantation too. In West Papua, especially Maroke, related to the development of Maroke Integrated Food and Energy Estate, or MAEFE. MAEFE is a project designed to develop an integrated food production covering agriculture, horticulture, and livestock in 1.6 million hectares of lowland forest and swamp. This program falls under law number 41-10-2009 on the protection of area for sustainable food agriculture, based on presidential instruction number 1-2010 and the acceleration of the development corridor of Maroke. This project will soon be implemented. There have been 30 private companies investing in this program. Meanwhile, this food industry is estimated to bring 6.4 million workers to Maroke in West Papua in general. The total population of West Papua is only 4.6 million people, where 2.2 million of this population are indigenous and 70% left in remote area. With a population of only 174,000 in Maroke, this plan will acutely threaten the existence of indigenous people within this area, turning them into a minority in number, even leading to extinction in the future. This is, as we may say, structural and systematic genocide. It is unacceptable. Therefore, we request the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to, 1. Urge the government of 1. Urge the government of Indonesia and other relevant UN state members not to relocate indigenous people in the establishment of public or private business interest project on indigenous land and territories. 2. Conduct an independent study on the impact of MIFI and other similar business to indigenous people in Morocco and around the world. We request the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedom of indigenous people to conduct a thematic study on development project including MIFI and their impact on cultural integrity and the human rights situation of indigenous people. We also urge the government of Indonesia to invite the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedom of indigenous people and the UN Special Rapporteur on the rights to food to visit and to make a report concerning the situation of indigenous people in Morocco and West Papua in general, affected by MIFI and other business development. I will submit the written statement in after this. Thank you, Chairperson.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Ms. Ida Nikolaisen from the International Group on Indigenous Issues. You have the floor.
Señora Nikolaisen.
Is Ms. Nikolaisen in the hall? No. Mr. Alexander Konstantinop of the Association of Indigenous Peoples of the North of Siberia.
Señor Konstantinop.
Mr. Konstantinop, is he in the hall? Please raise your hand. Mr. Konstantinop.
Señor Ronald.
Mr. Ronald Waromi of West Papua, of the Pacific region. Mr. Waromi, you have the floor.
Distinguished Chairperson of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, members of Permanent Forum, Indigenous brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to present the statement of West Papua Indigenous people. Before I present the statement in this very important event, allow me to express my feeling of pride and happiness in attending the 9th session of the UNPFII. I want also expressing my gratitude to the Secretariat of the UNPFII, who worked very hard to host this event, and I would like to thank you, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, with the UN Voluntary Fund for Indigenous Population. We West Papua Indigenous people continue to suffer discrimination, marginalization, extreme poverty, conflict, and human rights abuses. We face disposition of our traditional land and livelihood, displacement, destruction of our belief system, culture, identity, language, race, and way of life under the threat of extinction. Over 47 years, since 1963, our human rights and fundamental freedom in West Papua have never been fully guaranteed. This has been impeding the economic and social development of indigenous people in West Papua. The present Bill of Law of the Republic of Indonesia, number 21 of the year 2001 on the special autonomy to Papua, does not guarantee fully the freedom of expression of West Papuan rights and fundamental freedom that are protected by international instruments. In the era of the special autonomy, amidst various humanitarian problems, although the special autonomy was granted as a mean and solution to improve the life of indigenous people in West Papua, the human rights violations have increased, health problems have not been taken off, education, infrastructure, and welfare problems persist and increasingly deteriorate. Indigenous people of West Papua have no freedom of expression and have been arrested and suffer of sickness in prison. West Papua returners from Papua New Guinea that under the protection of UNHCR, after return home, did not obtain serious attention from Indonesian government, for almost 10 years to become self-support since the year 2000, causing many refugees' families died of hunger and illness. The indigenous people of West Papua in Timika were in scared situation. After 16 December 2009, Kelly Kwalik, the Free Papua Movement, Organisasi Papua Merdeka leader, was shot dead by Indonesian police in Timika, West Papua, near to Tembagapura, the PT Freeport Indonesia gold and copper mining. Through the ninth session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, we request the UN agency to support indigenous people organizations to carry out the activities in promoting and protecting the culture and language which is part of indigenous people identity. We request to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to assist West Papua refugees that voluntary repatriation to Indonesia from Papua New Guinea refugees camp. We, West Papua indigenous people, demand peace and justice. West Papua indigenous people call upon the United Nations for the realization of the provision contained in Article 3 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which state that indigenous people have the right to self-determination and the right to freely determine their political status. Self-determination will enable to end the conflict and human rights violation in West Papua, and self-determination will enable indigenous people in West Papua to reach the Millennium Development Goals. Thank you very much.
Acabamos de escuchar al último orador.
We've just heard the last speaker on my list for this morning. Next week, the Permanent Forum will continue with its program of work as contained in document E/C19/2010L.1. The meetings of the forum will take place in Conference Room 1 of the new United Nations headquarters building on the North Lawn. Room 1, North Lawn building. The Secretariat has some important announcements to make. Please, you have the floor.
I have three very quick announcements. The first is the security informs the participants that no special passes are going to be needed for non-governmental organizations for next week. So they can access the North Lawn building with their regular passes. Also, there is a closed meeting of the forum that will start at 3 o'clock. Please check in the UN journal. It indicates the room. Also, that today from 12 o'clock to 6 p.m., the Indigenous Craft Fair is happening in the church building on the 8th floor. And last but not least, on the occasion of the ninth session of the forum, there will be a special event honoring our esteemed member of the forum, Ms. Tonya Gonella Frischner, the North American representative to the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. There will be a buffet reception on Sunday, 25th April, at 2 o'clock, and it will last until 7 in the evening, honoring Ms. Gonella Tonya Frischner, and everybody is invited. Thank you.
Se levanta la sesión.
This meeting is adjourned.